This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. All right, the Q&A from the Jonathan Kitab lecture from November 16th here in Eugene. If you missed the first one, Jonathan Kitab is a co-founder of the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq and co-founder of Nonviolence International, a well-known international human rights attorney. Jonathan practices in the U.S., Palestine, and Israel. He serves on the board of Bethlehem Bible College and is president of the board of Holy Land Trust. Jonathan was the head of the legal committee negotiating the Cairo Agreement of 1994 between Israel and the PLO. After graduating with his Doctor of Jurisprudence from Virginia Law School and practicing a couple years in Wall Street, Jonathan returned home to Palestine. Jonathan was visiting scholar at Osgoode Law School at York University in Toronto in the fall of 2017 and is a founding director of Just Peace Advocates Movement Pour Une Paix Juste, a Canadian-based international law human rights not-for-profit organization. Jonathan is currently the executive director of Friends of Sabil North America. Jonathan is a resident of East Jerusalem and is a partner of Kitab, Khoury, and Hana law firm in East Jerusalem. All right, so that's coming up here on Talk Is Cheap. But first, continuing on with my Rojava update, very important to support Rojava at defendrojava.org. All right, this is a book called Hope Without Hope by Matt Broomfield, available on at defendrojava.org, I believe. Or, you know, you can get it from Amazon. This is from the chapter called The Rojava Revolution, subheading Outside the State. July 19, 2012 is now celebrated as the anniversary of the Rojava Revolution, yet there were few bullets fired as the dictator Bashar al-Assad's Syrian Arab Army units withdrew, and the Syrian Kurdish wing of Öcalan's movement. Öcalan is the head of the Rojava Revolutionary Movement, who and is now in prison, similar to the, you know, the track of the Zapatista movement. Öcalan's movement took control of Kurdish cities in the country's largely rural north. At this time, the Syrian regime was embattled. Following a 2011 pro-democratic anti-government uprising forming part of the Arab Spring, Syria's brave but under-resourced and disorganized grassroots opposition was rapidly overtaken by more organized armed Islamist groups sponsored by Turkey, Qatar, and the Muslim Brotherhood. Assad's cynical depiction of the opposition as nothing but violent jihadists soon became an effective reality as regime atrocities drove ordinary citizens to arms and Assad released thousands of veteran Salafi jihadists from jail. In the 1980s and 1990s, Assad had generally offered a safe haven to Öcalan and his PKK on the understanding that the latter would concentrate their attacks on Turkey. But in the post-Cold War era, Turkey and Syria reached an agreement that resulted in Öcalan's 1998 expulsion from Syria and eventual capture, followed by years of especially violent repression targeting his movement. Large numbers of local affiliates were subjected to detention, torture, or deportation by Assad's forces, including most of the party's senior leadership in Syria. Though the 2012 outbreak of civil war meant the Assad regime was now forced to liaise with the movement it had spent a decade repressing, its coordinated withdrawal from northern Syria was nonetheless cynically planned to abandon the Kurds to their fate, creating a buffer against Turkish military incursions and the Islamist opposition. And yet this withdrawal allowed Öcalan's followers the opportunity to move into the open and begin the seemingly paradoxical process of implementing their grassroots, bottom-up ideology at the region's newly dominant political and military force. As the region's newly dominant political and military force. There would be a price to pay later as the Syrian Kurdish People's Projected Units, or YPG, and the all-female Women's Protective Units, or YPJ, engaged in sporadic running battles against the Assad regime, their famously bitter campaign against ISIS, and the jihadist opposition and a still ongoing struggle against Turkish occupation. But from those first hours onward, as the major Syrian Kurdish cities fell without a fight into the Kurdish movement's control, Rojava's revolution survived in an ambiguous, productive zone between competing state powers. The confrontation between Syria and Turkey, two of the state powers that benefit from the colonial division of Kurdistan, created room for an autonomous and anti-statist alternative to emerge. So this group kind of profited off of the fighting between two states, is what this book is portending. Philosopher Giorgio Agamben has famously argued that the capitalist nation-state achieves hegemony through the necessary permanent exclusion of certain populations, voiding them of political agency and leaving them to live what he terms a barren existence outside society. Kurds in the Middle East, Jews in the Holocaust, migrants in Europe, the state proscribes certain limits to its violence only to suspend them in those exceptional cases, licensing violence against these barren populations, which then becomes the new ordinary for the whole of society. The rule suspending itself gives rise to the exception, and the whole population suffer under a permanent and increasingly global state of exception. Agamben thus politicizes those lives excluded from politics as traditionally understood by representing their exclusion as fundamental to the power of the contemporary state. So the very violence inflicted on these groups by the state is what creates their new society, is what this guy's saying. Akhalan II theorizes that a state of crisis has become perpetual across the globe, yet this concept rather serves to repoliticize the Kurds, supposedly bare life. The stateless Kurdish nation is restored to the center of Akhalan's global political analysis, granted a world historical role precisely thanks to their centuries-long exclusion from nation-state politics. The moment Akhalan determined the nation-state had to be surpassed as a political category, the Kurds' permanent exclusion from this supposedly history-ending political form was suddenly and alchemically transformed, making the stateless Kurds the founding subjects of a new political order. We in the West likely find ourselves struggling in some different zone of the global state exception, but could we imagine theorizing the world historic role of gig workers, climate refugees, or other potential subjects of contemporary anti-capitalist struggle with the same transformative force Akhalan has achieved for his own Kurdish people? Gassed and subjected to genocide in Iraq, executed in Iran, tortured in Syria, driven from burning villages in Turkey, systematically denied their language, identity, and legal existence, like other subjects of the state of exception, the Kurdish people know full well what it means to be excluded from the state. In Syria, the Kurds were written out of the state politics to the point that hundreds of thousands of them were literally denied identity papers, following a deeply racist 1960s policy intended to Arabize the country's north by displacing the Kurds, described as a malignant tumor in the body of the Arab nation. To this extent, Rojava, prior to its revolutionary organization by the Kurdish movements, was a case study of the desperate, excluded, barren life. This explains what happens when the Syrian state took the logical next step of withdrawing from those unwanted border cities filled with easily expendable Kurds, abandoning them as a buffer against Turkish incursions, mere meat, bare life. During the Syrian conflict, the country tellingly known as the Syrian Arab Republic spilled incredible amounts of blood to keep Arab-majority cities in its grasp. That it withdrew its forces to hand control to a ragtag Kurdish militia shows how little value it placed on the lives of its nominal Kurdish citizens. In the regime's view, Rojava was indeed a utopia, but in an original etymological sense, a non-place. What happens when the state of exception consumes itself and the barren, excluded population is literally abandoned altogether? Following Agamben, we might expect total death, obliteration, the permanent silencing of the excluded population. But the Kurdish movement, lean, hard, and organized from long years of struggle and deeply rooted in Rojava's villages and working-class neighborhoods, could offer a political alternative. All right, so that's what's going on. And if you remember, recently I read from Lowell Thomas's book on Lawrence of Arabia, and T.H. Lawrence says in there that Syria is basically, I'm oversimplifying this, and this isn't what's in this book necessarily, but you know, they're the Bedouins, they're the nomads, basically, of the Syrian population. Or these are the nomads, and so they can't be shoehorned into the capitalist society. That works in their favor. Okay, continuing on with Matt Broomfield's Hope Without Hope, and you can go to defendrojava.org for more information on this. And please, research this yourself, you know, don't take my word for anything. I'm on this ride with you. For the Rojava revolution was, through necessity, a revolution quite unlike previous statist revolutions. Following Öcalan's pragmatic, idealist critique of the nation-state, Syria's Kurds refused the obvious paths before them. Neither return to the pre-war status quo under Assad, nor acquiesce to Syria's dominant Islamist opposition forces. Neither bloody smash-and-grab expropriations in pursuit of centralized socialism, nor the establishment of an oil-rich capitalist client state like that across the border in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region of Iraq, or KRI. Kurdish nationalist in name, in practice, the KRI's rulers are willing collaborators with Turkey. Temporary alliances and pragmatic relationships with both the Syrian opposition and the Assad regime notwithstanding, from 2012 on, the Kurdish movement demanded a third way out of the Syrian crisis. This decision was surely proven correct by the rapid Islamification of the broader Syrian opposition, culminating in ISIS's 2014 rise to power. Reactionary, well-funded, state-backed forces determined to repress women's and minority rights achieved dominance at the expense of the disorganized and isolated local communities that had initially attempted to direct the broader resistance against Assad. This is perhaps the greatest political tragedy of the Syrian revolution. In theory, there was a clear ideological affinity between these ad hoc local councils and the Kurdish movement's vision for a municipal and devoted and devolved Syria, and in cities like Manbij and Raqqa, Arab opposition figures who had suffered under the resisted ISIS could and did take up the opportunity to play a leading role in governing their cities through the AANES's own local councils. But the opposition's Islamification and forced reliance on Turkish sponsorship, coupled with the AANES's own negotiated truce with Assad, prohibited the rise of any broader federation capable of spreading secular and democratic governance nationwide. Instead, it was Al-Qaeda offshoot Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, who ultimately managed to depose Assad in pursuit of their own authoritarian agenda. So that's where they're at right now. All right, continue on with Hope Without Hope by Matt Broomfield. With these organizational realities in mind, we can avoid any simplistic, idealistic analyses that treat Rojava as a straightforward, positive utopia, rendering it a sort of anarcho-feminist Potemkin village or adventurous experiment doomed to fail. Here's a representative example. While I was working in Rojava, Black Lives Matter protesters in Seattle took temporary control of a few streets, declaring the small strip of asphalt a cop-free Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ. At the behest of a U.S. newspaper, I was dispatched to interview a Kurdish political organizer on potential parallels between the AANES, which is an area 50,000 square kilometers, population 4 million, and dates active 2012 through present, and the CHAZ, which has an area of 6 city blocks and a park population, low thousands, dates active 3 weeks in June 2020. She responded with the typical stern maternalism of an experienced Kurdish militant. Quote, I don't think that will work. The time is clearly not right. They need to go home and begin conversations in their own communities with those around them. All right, continuing on with Hope Without Hope. This is the chapter, Revitalizing and Reorganizing the Left. Right Populism, Hope for the Hopelessness. It's little wonder that many young people are turning to the ultra-cynical alt-right and popular nativism. From Donald Trump's U.S. to Jair Bolsonaro's Brazil, these ideologies offer an alternative, grimly compelling narrative to the liberal hope industry's vague promises of hope as equal access resource. Across the board, the contemporary right's discourse is marked by a jaded negative solidarity, the logic of, if I can't have it, they can't either. This plays out a self-defeating and self-pitying politics that invests hope solely in excluding the other from a nation-state rather than the more traditional conservative goal of preserving the good life for nation's subjects. This is what we could characterize as an alt-right hope for hopelessness, conditioning people to make a political virtue of their own suffering and the marginalization of the other rather than seeking actual transformation in their own lives. Trump, Bolsonaro, Hungary's Viktor Orban, Argentina's Javier Milei, and indeed Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan are among the right populist heads of state to have peddled variants of this negative solidarity and hope for hopelessness, expanding alt-right tactics onto the global stage by repackaging a reactionary nativism as somehow transgressive and countercultural. Anger against neoliberal elites is channeled into electoral politics and sporadic street violence while those elites secure themselves a seat at the government table under the false premise that they will overturn it. Meanwhile, the left struggles to articulate a historic alternative capable of drawing these frustrated, alienated populations away from the lure of nativist vitriol, blaming immigrants, ethnic scapegoats, and LGBTQI plus people for their socioeconomic plight. The right populists' isolationist, protectionist, America First-style rhetoric belies their comfortable accommodation with the neoliberal order. Though they might talk of protectionism or isolationism, none of them would ever disentangle their nations from the global market or global debt relations. Rather, their authoritarian regimes typically serve as the local guarantors of unfettered free market access. On this point, it's worth revisiting the work of neoliberal ideologue Francis Fukuyama, who infamously heralded the end of history and the permanent victory of liberal capitalist hegemony. His critics variously point to the surge in right populist nativism, 9/11, the recent waves of global protest, Russia's war on Ukraine, and Israel's war on Gaza, as evidence that historical crises and upheavals continue. But Fukuyama never claimed there would be no more global conflict, only that after the decline of communism and fascism, regional, ethnic, or religious disputes would no longer trouble the historically destined forms of liberal democracy and the market economy. While liberal democracy may tremble on the point of market capitalism, continued hegemony, Fukuyama is yet to be disproven. All right, so coming up, Jonathan Kutab. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. KPW 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works, Independent Community Radio.
The United States made a bunch of compromises with the slave states,
yeah.
And we're still living with that garbage.
Yeah.
This business of a Senate that where my buddy in Casper, Wyoming, has much more power than I have.
So when he look at you, he look at the people at the same
great,
time.
Great. Okay. So if you build into a state that actually where people start getting along, where you have to have certain people Jewish, way up in power, and certain people. Did you say
Palestinian? Yeah.
But so, for one thing, some Palestinians were Jewish in 1947, mm-hmm. And if this is a state where people get along, in a few generations, they're going to forget about their religions, and they're all going to be intermarried. And if you have some law that you have to be Jewish, and you have to be something else.
No. Okay. Good question. My proposal is not an ideal proposal, but it is a workable proposal. It meets the needs of people where they are today. And the where people are today is that the vast majority of Israeli Jews are not willing to make compromise with Palestinians because they are stuck with this security mentality. I need to satisfy their security needs, but I need to build in protections for everybody else. Some people said maybe there should be a sunset clause for 50 years. Maybe that's possible. But the truth is, we are so far from that ideal that you think of when people no longer care whether they are Jewish or not, or whether they are a Palestinian or not. Certainly, it's an ideal to think about, but right now, we need something practical that people can live with. And right now, a nuclear-armed Israel is not going to accept or give up or think of any solution that does not address its security needs and its security fears. And I'm trying to address them without at the same time ignoring the Palestinian fears and the Palestinian needs. Because we suffer also under the police and the Shin Bet and the security services and what they do to us. So it doesn't mean that everybody in the army will have to be Jewish or in the police has to be Palestinian. But it gives a sense of satisfaction, a sense of guarantee. And I think more importantly will be the second part, which is we must build new relationships. We must have the outside world guarantee this agreement instead of undermine it. Everybody has an investment in making this work. So yes, it is not perfect. I totally agree with you. But it's at least an attempt in the right direction. The question is, do you think that more Israelis would support that kind of a one-state solution or less? And the answer is, right now, the answer is less. Right now, the right wing in Israel is very dominant. But that's only to be expected. Right now, the supremacy, the Jewish supremacy in Israel, is blatant. Very few people in Israel today would talk a lot about how democratic it is. That's what they say to the Americans. They don't care very much now about democracy. They want their state to be Jewish. That's the dominant mentality. But you know, this is not surprising. Any time people who have privilege hear the talk about equality, they're scared. For them, equality means you're taking away my superior rights. Equality to them spells suppression. If you're taking away slavery, you're stealing my property. If you talk about equality for women, you're taking away my male prerogatives and privileges. So people don't give up their rights that quickly. They have to be forced by internal or external reasons to give up their rights. And right now Israel feels that the world is turning against us, that the only thing that helps us is the United States. And if the United States changes its mind, as it might, we will be left alone. So instead of seeking peace through equality, through a coalition that believes that racism is bad and superiority is bad. They build this idea that we are in danger. Just like in South Africa, the whites said, if we have majority rule, we will be massacred. They were not massacred in South Africa. They weren't. It is possible, and then I mentioned that in this book, it is possible for a minority to thrive, not just survive, but thrive, and even be dominant in certain sectors while they are still a minority. The question is there a mechanism that allows for equality, that allows for, because see, you're not going to be able to end hatred and discrimination, but you can outlaw discrimination in public affairs, in employment, in housing, in distribution of resources. This is basically what the US Constitution does. It outlaws that type of official discrimination. Discrimination continues, and it's an ongoing struggle to work for equality, but at least it is not part of the established laws of the country that you discriminate.
This may be irrelevant, I don't know, a dumb idea, but it seems to me that the Israelis think that this land is theirs from, like that horrible book says, time immemorial. But if you look at the story of Abraham, he was an immigrant. He immigrated from Iraq, probably. And then the other Jews who came in later were also immigrants from Europe. And the people who were there all the time, I think, were Palestinians and their ancestors.
Okay. I very deliberately refused to go into the type of historical justification for either party. I could do it. I can do it very well. I also refuse to go into the international law aspects. What does international law say? Who has a greater claim under international law? I refuse to go into the moral, who is more of a victim? Who suffered more? Who violated human rights more? I could do it. I know I could do it. In other places I do it. I say taking things as they are today. Is there a way out? Is there a solution that commends itself to people of goodwill on both sides? Is there something that you can at least aspire to? A vision that you can say, yeah, that's worth working towards, rather than work towards a Jewish state or a Palestine Arabiya, which requires me to continue fighting and fighting till I totally eliminate the other side.
Or they eliminate me.
Or they eliminate me, yeah. And I'm saying we can't eliminate each other. We are destined to live together, and we have to find a formula that allows us to do that. Question is, what about the United States and international complicity? And the answer, I think, is clear. I wish the United States was not involved. In fact, it is involved. It's involved on the wrong side of history. It's involved in being directly complicit in the genocide that's taking place, not only by providing money, which it does, not only by providing weapons, which it does, but mostly by providing diplomatic cover, whether it's through the veto at the United Nations or through pressuring other countries not to be involved in international law and the ICC and the ICJ. So the United States is involved, unfortunately, as part of the problem rather than the solution. However, it's possible for all that to change, and I think it will change. And when it changes, I think you'll see things change very quickly and very rapidly. And I just am hoping that we here as Americans, we'll make sure that it happens in the right way. Not out of anti-Israeli sentiment, but out of really caring for both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, as well as international law itself.
I hope you consider this.
Your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Rick Stagenborg.
Al-Haq, Al-Haq. The question is, what about the organization I've been involved with, Al-Haq, which is a human rights organization? Israel has declared Al-Haq to be a terrorist organization. The United States government has also imposed, or at least announced, sanctions against Al-Haq for daring to collect information and present it to the International Criminal Court. For daring to do what it's supposed to do, to work on human rights. So yes, we do have a problem. In fact, it's curious that Israel, which for many years pretended to be part of the democratic world, the only democracy in the Middle East, the rule of law, wonderful independent courts, etc., these days they don't care. These days they openly say, we will do what we want because we are powerful enough to do it. And they are encouraged by hearing sounds coming from this part of the world, from this country, that also treats international law as irrelevant, that asks Zelensky, what cards do you have to play? That's what's important. We are strong enough. Who is Denmark? Maybe we need to take Greenland. Maybe we need to take the Panama Canal. Maybe we need to take Canada and call it the 51st state. This type of total disregard for international law and international norms is very common in Israel today. In Israel, you hear that all the time. There's a new word in Hebrew now that you hear all the time. It's called, so what? Literally, it has entered the Hebrew lexicon. Yeah, international law and the Geneva Convention, so what? Yeah, the International Criminal Court says, you know, we can't do this, so what? Yeah, we are killing babies, and yeah, we are cutting off food, and yes, we want to destroy all bases for life in Gaza and make it unlivable. So what? So what? We can get away with it. As long as the United States is allowing us. It is something to think about. Do we live in a world which is based only on power?
Or do we have some respect for international law and the opinion of countries and the judgment of history on us and on our children?
This is going to be the hardest question because it's coming from my son.
Okay. So my question is that the two-state solution idea keeps there. Like France is supporting and England and... France is supporting it, saying we're going to declare recognition for Palestine and we support the two-state solution, and everybody else does. So my question is, when all these governments are talking about the two-state solution, what should the response be?
Okay. For many countries, you're right. The issue of a two-state solution is one step in the right direction. However, it has become an alibi to avoid dealing with the real conflict. Because we're working for a two-state solution. Someday there will be a Palestinian state. We don't know when and we don't know how. The people who talk about a two-state solution, who are not willing to challenge the settlements, to roll back the settlements, are lying. It's an alibi. And you know, when I discovered this about 7 years ago, when I met Thomas Dine, who used to be the head of AIPAC for 20 years. And I said, I want to ask you a question. What's the position of AIPAC? Before I finished the sentence, he said, two-state solution.
Could you explain what AIPAC is?
Yes. AIPAC is the Zionist lobby that uses a lot of power over Congress. And
they own it.
They own the Congress in many ways. Yes. When I asked him, what is your position? He quickly said, two states. Really? AIPAC supports the two-state position? No. It's their alibi. It's their way to avoid dealing with the issues that are raised by the occupation. If you truly believe in a two-state solution, you start demanding an end to the settlement and an end to the occupation and rolling back the settlements. But none of them are doing it. So this is what I would say to anybody who says they support the two-state solution. I say, wonderful. I used to support it. I used to work very hard for it. And the only reason I moved beyond that is because I became convinced that it is no longer possible. So I would tell these countries that now recognize or belatedly started recognizing Palestine. It's very interesting that these countries only started recognizing the state of Palestine when their own population rose up and say, this genocide is horrible. You have to do something. Okay, we'll do something. We'll recognize the state of Palestine, but there will be no consequences to this recognition. So anybody who tells you they believe in two-state solutions, say, great, wonderful. What are you doing to end the occupation of the West Bank? Never mind. Never mind the rest of Palestine. And if they tell you nothing, we don't do BDS, boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. We don't cut off aid from Israel as long as it's occupying these territories. We want to see concrete action to allow people to move in and out of Gaza and the West Bank and allow people to have open borders and be allowed to bring in food and medicine. Then you really don't believe in a two-state solution. You're just lying to me. This is just an alibi for you not to deal with the problem that we're facing.
Hi, I'm Karen McCowan, and I'm a member of People for Peace and Justice in Palestine. And thank you for coming. I would love to hear your take on the role of Christian Zionism, Christian nationalism in this country, and its tentacles in the controlling party. And if you see any hope or any signs that is changing.
Yeah. First of all, Christian Zionism is really more of a political than a theological.
You only have 5 minutes and we end.
Okay, group. It is beginning to become weaker, including among groups like evangelicals who used to support it. Especially young people no longer really accept that position. Christian nationalism, which is really a form of white supremacist, while they were supportive, very supportive of this of Zionism and the State of Israel, are also now questioning again, why should we be paying money and weapons to a country that has free health insurance and free college education to everybody, while we can't afford to do that to our own people? Because these people, their support of Zionism and the State of Israel is very shallow and can change very quickly because they really don't like Jews or Muslims or Catholics or Latinos or African American or anybody else who's not like them. They may find it politically convenient to pretend to be supportive of the State of Israel, but it's not because they like Jews or they care about them. This is why I want to make it clear in case you had any question about it. Anti-Jewish bigotry and racism and discrimination is wrong and evil and a sin, and we should oppose it. And we should oppose it on principle, not because we like Palestinians and we hate Israel. So you have to have a principled opposition to all forms of racism rather than pretend that you do it. Thank you.
I want to express something and hear your response to it. You spoke about Israel wanting peace and the, you know, after the 67 war and everything. I would say, from my background in nonviolent communication, the deeper need is to feel safe. Jews want to feel safe. And I say that as a Jewish American who had a stepmother who's a survivor of Auschwitz. And even though Israel is armed to the teeth with tanks and airplanes and nuclear weapons, they still don't feel safe.
Correct.
And when I was there, like, right. many people walking around with guns, you know, M16 right. rifles everywhere, right. walking around with guns. Can you talk about things that Palestinians can do, and Palestinian leaders and Arab leaders and other leaders in the world and Americans can do to give Jews a sense of safety, of feeling safe, so they'll let go of this craziness Good. That I'm just
Good question.
Outraged. I'm outraged by what Israel is doing and the U.S. is doing. But I know that at the base is this fear of annihilation, that it'll happen again.
Good question.
There.
Good question.
Thank you.
You'd be surprised. I think it's a very good question. I think one thing we can do is tell them that weapons don't get you security. If you feel unsafe, we don't give you more tanks. We don't feed that wolf on your left shoulder that says we need more weapons. I know you tell them that your safety lies in the safety and security of your Palestinian brothers and sisters. Oh, yeah. That's where you get the safety. It's a tough sell, I know, because Israelis have been indoctrinated by Zionism. You'd be shocked that the Nazis were correct. Blood and iron is the only thing that counts. And we need to tell them, no, that's not true. Your safety is not built on weapons and military might. Your safety is built on legitimacy and acceptance, and that only comes through justice through the Palestinians, and not by having more weapons be given to you.
So I'm going to ask, what about capitalism? Because so many of the support, you know, for AIPAC comes from billionaires. And to what extent are they motivated by greed? And particularly the military-industrial complex that is so integrated with Jewish, and I'm not going to say Jewish, but Israeli military. Okay, so this is a big global engine supporting capitalism.
Oh boy, I only have 2 minutes, so I will only tell you that the influence of money in US politics is horrible. It is not only endangering Israelis and Palestinians, it's also endangering democracy in this country. It's endangering the environment. It's endangering human rights. It's endangering international cooperation. Against everything. So yes, we do need to address that, but I don't have time to do it now. Sorry.
What is FASNA?
Ah.
What are you doing?
Thank you. I am now executive director of FASNA, Friends of Sabeel North America. Sabeel is a Palestinian Christian liberation theology movement representing all denominations. We are a pacifist group. We believe in justice. We are an ecumenical group representing all denominations. FASNA, I really would urge you to look at our website. It's fosna.org, FASNA.org, or you can sign the the paper at the table there, so that you will get our weekly newsletter, and I write a weekly blog also in Fasna. We are not dogmatically, but unashamedly Christian and Palestinian and nonviolent. We believe in nonviolence, and we believe in justice for Palestine.
I have been a resident in Lane County for the past 40 years. I've gone to high school here. I've got my degrees. I have a PhD in political science and law. And I have been an active, strong supporter of Palestine. By my writing, I used to write frequently for the Register Guard and the Oregonian, as well as Christian Science Monitor. So one of my problems with, by the way, I want to thank you, this church, and whoever invited our distinguished speaker. One of the things that would have helped this get together would have been a discussant. In other words, after our distinguished speaker would have given his points, then a discussant would have taken off from some of the points that the main speaker did not have to cover. Chief among them, let me tell you briefly that the state of Israel, if you want to call it a state, was born in violence. If you have read it, currently one of my articles is going around the globe. You're welcome to look at it. It's called From Declaration to Disposition: The Theft of Palestinian Land and the Birth of Israel. The point is, nobody talked about, and our distinguished, he had quite a few points to discuss, but the way Israel was built was on a letter. I have gone through the trouble of finding the original letter, and it's embedded in my article. It's called the Balfour Letter. It is basically 119 words, but 67 of it deal with how Israel is to be born. Israel was not born in the pages of the Bible. This is a church. Please leave the medical story of Israel behind and pay attention to see how it really came into being. Therefore, with all deference to our distinguished speaker, I don't believe Israel is going to go away peacefully. The best thing I can tell you is our former very distinguished reporter, correspondent by the name of Helen Thomas. Mm-hmm. Helen Thomas said basically the current population of Israel should go where they come from. It is very difficult for Palestinians to live next door to someone who has killed generationally for 80 years. For 80 years, ladies and gentlemen, there is not a single sound that comes from the United States that describes the pain of Palestine and its people. It's silent. I went to high school here. There is no textbook in high school. There is nothing. Absolutely nothing. So therefore, okay. I'm sorry to say, you see, I don't have time to rebut some of the points that our distinguished speaker gave, but at the same time, I think it's worth talking about it.
I deliberately avoided going into the history. I have a lot to say about the history.
Excuse me.
The Balfour Declaration, I'm very well aware of. The bitter history, the suffering of the Palestinian people, the human rights violations, I'm well aware of. And there are times when I do address these things in great length. I deliberately avoided it to say that we are now at a juncture where we need to move forward. It may be possible, it may not be possible, but I want to say that we should have a vision for the future, not only for the past. I fully respect the Palestinian who says, I cannot accept. They have to all go back where they came from. But I would tell that Palestinian friend, to do that, you really need to thoroughly defeat, including militarily, the state of Israel, and create so much bloodshed and destruction. I am opting for something different. And I fully respect, if you want to fight and continue to fight, go ahead. God bless you. I don't think he will, but God bless you. Go ahead. And I also say the same thing to any Israeli Zionist. If you really think you can totally destroy and abolish the Palestinian people, you're mistaken. We will continue to survive even if we have no weapons. With every possible advantage on your side, you have failed to destroy Palestinian nationalism. The young people today are more clear about their identity as Palestinians than their parents and grandparents were. So we need to find a way for these two to live together. And I think we have a way for them to live together. If not, they will continue to fight forever.
Thank you. I agree very much with your vision, your view of what should be over in the Middle East. My question is, what should each one of us do here in this room when we wake up tomorrow morning to help make that happen?
Wonderful, wonderful question. Wonderful question. I think that there are many things we can do incrementally towards that vision. We don't have to wait till that vision comes about. For example, we can work to end the siege of Gaza. Allow food and medicine and freedom of movement in and out of Gaza with no restriction and limitations. That's something you could work towards. Feed Gaza. Prevent the use of starvation as a weapon. Number two, bring the war criminals to justice. I don't care if they are Hamas or if they are Arab leaders or if they are American leaders or if they're Israeli leaders. Those who have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity should be brought to justice, should not be free to roam the world and go into different countries as if they are ordinary people. They're not. They are criminals. They are monsters. They have to be brought to justice. Here's another thing that you can work on. Three, call Israel to account for its actions in the West Bank. There's no Hamas there. There's no armed resistance there. And yet every day they are going around uprooting trees, killing people, including American citizens. There's four villages around Ramallah, which are 70% of them are Palestinian Americans with citizenship, who are being attacked almost daily. Their trees uprooted, their homes and cars burnt, and they're shot and killed by total thugs who are Jewish settlers. Bring an end to that. Work on that. Bring acceptance and recognition to Palestinians and Palestinian voices. Right now, you can't even come to the United States with a Palestinian passport, or let's say passe, because they are prevented. These are interim steps, okay? End the apartheid regime. Insist on laws that should be applied equally to Arabs and Jews alike, whether it's in the West Bank or in Israel itself. The fight against apartheid is a necessary fight. Again, all these steps are short, far short of the vision I described, but they are concrete steps. And finally, I think, is work inside the churches against Christian Zionism. Work against AIPAC and its influence in politics. Challenge your Congress people who are sending money and weapons and support for the State of Israel. There are many things that you can do, including even using the word Palestine and wearing a keffiyeh, which is now being prevented in many places. Speak up for your own freedoms of expression, academic freedom. Use BDS, boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against corporations and individuals who are involved in this ongoing genocide. And dare your churches to start using the word genocide and call it for what it is. These are concrete things that you can do immediately. You don't have to wait until we create this new wonderful vision of a single state to start working for justice.
Thank you, Jonathan.
If you want to purchase any of them, so feel free to look at the table, and there are other books that you, if you wish, you can purchase. Also, we have a petition.